Athletic.
All right, Reds, Tony Evans here with Walk On, your Liverpool podcast from The Athletic. The race is back on. Well, actually, it was never really off, was it? Because until whoever wins the league are mathematically secure, Liverpool are still in it. And they ran riot down by the Thames and stuck three past Fulham. Well, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about Trent's dead ball brilliance and bring you the latest in the managerial search before looking forward to the trip to Goodison. All that with James Pearce and Andy Jones, as well as the return of the quiz. I bet you're excited about that. Before the derby, a quiz. What could get you more hyped up than a quiz before the derby? I don't know. James, does that hype you up before the derby?
It does, yeah. Absolutely thrilled.
Andy, are you bouncing because there's a quiz coming?
That's why I'm here. That's the only reason I signed up for this one.
All right. Even more exciting than the quiz is our weekly three words. I'm going to throw it to you, Andy.
I'm going to go with back in business.
James.
I'm going to stick with the three that I picked last week when you scoffed at me. I still believe.
Well, I didn't completely scoff, but, you know, it's difficult to believe too much. You know, it's... And let's see what they're saying over on the Walk On podcast Facebook group. Andy Mercer, Darius Better, Tom Wilkinson, we've missed Trent, Dave Wilson, why no Ruben? ! And Lee Taylor, let's go again.
To join our community of listeners on Facebook, just search Walk On Podcast and join the group.
Alexander-Arnold, and Jim! Joyful execution from Trent Alexander-Arnold!
Let's talk about Fulham. I mean, that looked like a really tricky fixture, didn't it? And yet they went there, and of course, Trent scored another brilliant free kick. And he has a habit of doing that sort of thing, and he's been missed, hasn't he, heavily?
Yeah, big time. I think, you know, the two performances he's put in from the start, really. I thought he was brilliant at Atalanta, and, you know, I thought he was excellent again. And he seems to be starting matches with an incredible switch of play to Luis Diaz at the moment to sort of set a tone for himself and the team. And yeah, there was just no doubt when he was stood over that free kick. I think what was just mad about it was the fact that they decided Harvey Elliott should be on the first one. And his questionable attempt to try and... deceive the wall. But yeah, when Trent was over it, he's been in that position so many times, and I was surprised he's only scored six in the Premier League from free kicks. I thought it'd be more than that, but I mean, he's just got such quality, and you know, I think it summed it up that he was wheeling away in celebration before it even hit the back of the net, and it was a reminder of his quality. But him being in the team has just been a reminder of his brilliance and his importance, and while he probably wasn't missed as much as we thought he might be at times with you know, Conor Bradley's form and Joe Gomez playing well as well, I think when he's back in the team, you just realise what you are missing. He's back, maybe not quite in time, but he's back to give Liverpool a massive boost, you know, heading into the end of the season.
Definitely. And that surprised me, that stat there, James. That he's only scored six free kicks. It feels like a lot more. I mean, where does he stand in the great free kick takers at the club? Obviously, Stephen, the captain, Gerrard was the very best, but who else is as good as Trent?
Yeah, it's difficult really to think of a better ball striker than Trent. I mean, Jamie Redknapp scored a few free kicks, didn't he, in his time? And obviously, yeah, you're right. Gerrard's probably the benchmark in terms of some of the iconic ones. But yeah, it was just so refreshing, wasn't it? After what has been a pretty grim couple of weeks for Liverpool. To see Trent back out there pulling the strings, it was the free kick was magnificent, but it was, for me, it was also just the sight of him back in central areas on the ball, dictating play, you know, playing some of those 50, 60 yard diagonal passes perfectly to feet. He gave Liverpool something that they've really, really missed, and there was a freshness to Liverpool. I think that had been lacking for a few weeks. And I think part of that is down to the changes Klopp made. I thought it was a bit of a gamble, I think, because I think if it had gone the other way, then he would have been open to criticism, having left out so many big names, you know, especially in that midfield area. You had Trent stepping into midfield with, you know, you had Endo, Harvey Elliott and Ryan Gravenberch in there. And between them, they ensured that Liverpool were, you know, were in control for, I'd say, all but probably that 10-minute period before halftime.
Yeah, definitely. Andy, I mean, when I saw the team, I thought, Jürgen's gone D-mob mad, you know, at the end, leaving Salah and Nunes on the bench. You know, you're like, oh, well, what's he thinking? And part of me thought, well, at the stage, behind in the title race, we wanting someone else to slip up, I can kind of see you might as well roll the dice. And it worked.
Yeah, it did. It was a surprise. But then at the same time, you think, you know, how many of those players have looked either out of form, out of rhythm, or just tired?
Well, you were in Bergamo, weren't you? And you saw a really poor performance from Salah.
Yeah, I mean, you could see it in Italy, really, is that they started well. He got half an hour in and were really good. And Salah missed that chance, and then the valve was sort of released and all the pressure was let out, and Liverpool sort of wilted after that, and it turned into a bit of a, you know, going out with a whimper. And there was problems there for, you know, Salah and Szoboszlai, for example, who, you know, the difference makers earlier in the season, and that's sort of the piece that I wrote. And you know, I've worked with Mark Carey on a piece on Salah, which will be coming out tomorrow. Just sort of looking at his game and sort of, you know, the run of form or bad form that he's in at the moment, and sort of trying to understand why that's the case. But then you had players like McAllister who just look like they've played too much football. And I think Klopp sort of, after the Atalanta second leg, sort of was in awe of how McAllister had actually managed to even come through the game. So it wasn't a surprise in the sense that, and Klopp usually does this every now and again, deep into a season, he will throw one in a bit of a, I remember Newcastle away went, you know, similar a couple of years ago when Diaz plays on the right and he rests a couple of the big guns and Naby Keita plays and scores that day, I think. So he can do this, but I think it is a massive gamble. And as you say, you know, if it goes wrong, you know, he's getting even more pelters and he's coming for a fair bit of criticism, you know, as the team have in recent weeks and for understandable reasons. But, you know, he goes with fresh legs. And I think as you saw that, one of the things that Atalanta, as I said, was that, you know, Liverpool lost the ability to be intense, but the fact that they had the fresh legs on, that wasn't the case this time. And instead of wilting after half time, they got stronger and had a really strong 15 minutes after the break, score the goal, get back in front, and then he's able to bring on some of the more experienced players, if you like, or, you know, just more energy from players who wouldn't have had a 90 in the legs. And now you're going to Goodison in a place where you've got some rhythm and form back into players who hadn't necessarily been involved that much. And you've also got rest into your big guns. So you've got a nice selection headache going into the game.
Yeah, James, I wonder, are we seeing the tail end of Salah, given his age, given the hamstring injury, given the changes in the recruitment department, and that with his contract being up in a year's time? And if it is that, I'd just love to see a final flourish from him.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to say at the moment what the future holds for Mo Salah at Liverpool. I think will hinge on the discussions that him and his agent have with Richard Hughes, the new sporting director, and of course the conversations with the new manager that comes in, and, you know, what reassurances he gets, but, you know, and kind of vice versa, I guess, in terms of what Salah says to the new manager about what his ambitions are in the next few years. I still hope he stays around. I would love to see him sign another 2 year, maybe, you know, for another 2 years. And, you know, he's only, what does he be, 32, won't he, coming up in June? And yeah, he's had a lean spell. And I think, you know, as we talked about it previously, I think watching him in the last month or so, I think there is a kind of, I think there is that kind of barrier in terms of maybe not trusting his body 100%, having come back from that hamstring injury. And of course, he came back once and aggravated it. And this is a player that, you know, for the previous 5 or 6 years was incredibly durable and barely missed a match. So I don't really buy the idea that we were seeing the kind of the downturn of Mohamed Salah, and that, you know, he won't get back to where he was. I just think he's in a tricky period at the minute. But yeah, I think it was a bonus, the fact you could go to Fulham, perform like that without him. He gets a bit of a breather. I would say it's almost nailed on. If as long as he's fit, he'll start at Goodison on Wednesday night.
I think the injury points are a good one, because as James said, with the durability thing, Salah's not used to in mid-season having to try and refine rhythm. He's usually always got it because he's always playing. And rhythm's become a big thing, and it's a thing that Klopp focuses on a lot, and he's referenced it a couple of times in recent games. And, you know, Curtis Jones was one example that he used recently, and sort of not having the time to really find rhythm. But I think that's part of it. And the other thing is, I think these long seasons do have an effect, because when I was doing the Salah piece, I look back at his sort of form after the AFCON 2 years ago, and I know it's a little bit different, and he got to the final in that one, and you know, there was the letdown of not winning it. Mane won it, of course. But, you know, Mane came back and was excellent. And Salah, I think it was 8 goals in 25. And that's not good from Salah. You know, he will have been disappointed. But for his standards, they weren't up to the levels. And I do wonder if, obviously different this time with the injury, but it's similar in that, you know, it's taken out of the Liverpool rhythm and it's trying to find that. And I do think as well that not having Trent Alexander-Arnold has a massive impact, or has had a massive impact, because, as I say, as well as Bradley and Gomez have done, they're not the facilitator that Trent is, in that Salah knows he's going to get found by Alexander-Arnold with different passes, and Gomez and Bradley don't necessarily have that ability because they're different types of players. So I think it all just comes together a little bit, because his numbers aren't that bad. But I think the Brighton game summed it up the best, in that he had, what was it, 12 shots. You know, he got in the position so many times, but just, you know, his finishing was just off, and he scores the winner in the game. But I think that sort of sums it up, that it's just a bit of a form thing rather than a, you know, he's completely gone in terms of his, you know, his ability levels, and he'll never return to those levels. He's obviously a different player than he was 2-3 years ago, but he's still class, and he's just having a bit of a bad patch, and that's what happens sometimes with players.
Have your say and get involved by emailing walk-on@theathletic.com.
James, you talked about a lot will depend on the new manager as well. Well, on Monday, David Ornstein revealed that West Ham are considering a move for Ruben Amorim, who, of course, has been in the frame for Liverpool. Yeah, let's hear what David had to say.
Well, this is a real surprise. It's a story that we broke on The Athletic a little bit out of the blue, because while we knew Amorim is expected to leave Sporting Lisbon this summer, and much of the speculation has focused on Liverpool, it's actually West Ham who have attempted to steal a march in the process by holding conversations with Amorim, his representatives, about the possibility of taking their managerial position if David Moyes is to depart this summer. But to set their sights on Amorim, so highly rated and coveted, is a real sign of ambition. The potential opening is thought to appeal to Amorim, but that doesn't mean that they are his first choice. We don't know where West Ham stand in his mind. My information is that a move by Liverpool for Amorim is now regarded as unlikely. That will come as a surprise to many who thought he might have been nailed on because of the reports that have emerged, particularly in Portugal. But those reports were not replicated over here, because our information has always been that, yes, Ruben Amorim is in the conversation for Liverpool, but he's not a shoo-in. They are running a thorough, methodical process that is considering a number of candidates to fit what they want in terms of the profile and the key criteria. They won't be afraid to be brave and bold in their own decision. It might not be a populist choice. Michael Edwards, the CEO of football for Fenway Sports Group, and Richard Hughes, the incoming sporting director, are not going to be making this appointment for the public applause. They want to make this appointment for the good of Liverpool, and it may take some more time. Right now, it would seem that might not be Amorim. And in terms of whether it will be West Ham, we just cannot say at this point in time. But certainly, it's a development that not many people saw coming.
Well, James, the one thing, and all the people I've spoken to, well, the one person I didn't see coming was Amorim. There was no real strong conviction, as David sees, from people at the club that he was anywhere near a certainty, was there?
Yeah, that's obviously how we've reported it. Because I think, you know, obviously in a situation like this with so much speculation and noise around it, I think immediately after Xabi Alonso ruled himself out of the running, you know, people just kind of clung to Amorim as, well, obviously it must be him then. And to be fair, as David reflected then, Liverpool's stance has always been that, no, we are in the middle of a process here, assessing a wide range of candidates, and there isn't a front runner in this process. And of course, you know, with Amorim, you know, as much as you look at the job he's done at Sporting and say, well, you know, he has to be in the mix because, you know, obviously on the brink of winning the title for the second time there. And but he's, you know, stylistically, there's probably questions in terms of, obviously, you know, he plays three at the back. And I think, what is he, 39 years of age? So it's completely different with respect to the Portuguese league coming to the Premier League and dealing with, you know, the worldwide scrutiny of life as Liverpool manager. So I think he's always been in the part of the conversation, but never probably as strong as some of the reports have been. And obviously there was reports, wasn't there, a couple of weeks ago that it was a done deal. He'd already agreed a 3-year contract, and, you know, Amorim himself knocked that down heavily. Liverpool were adamant it wasn't true. And I'm even more convinced now that is not the case. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. You wonder whether, in a way, it probably suits Amorim and his people to have it out there that West Ham are keen to secure his services, because you wonder whether there might be a little bit of a game there in terms of flushing out bigger offers and better opportunities than taking over at the London Stadium. So, but yeah, it's just going to be intriguing to see where Liverpool go. I think there isn't an obvious contender, is there? That's the thing. You know, Edwards and Hughes are on this search trying to find someone who ticks all the boxes for them, but there isn't another one even anywhere close to the kind of caliber and experience of Jurgen Klopp when Liverpool last appointed a manager in 2015.
Then, Andy, it was obvious he was the best man for the job. But, I mean, you just look. And normally, the bookies, they make money because they get things right. And you can look at the bookies and get sense. But they've got Arnie Slot's a final, the second favourite. Gary O'Neill's creeping up as well. De Zerbi's in there, Tuchel, Thomas Frank. But no one's got much of an idea of where they're going. I think one of the things that Michael Edwards has proved during his career at Liverpool is he's predictably unpredictable.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? And I think the sort of, yeah, the number of names that are sort of being bandied around sort of sums it up. And there's always that sort of danger, isn't there, that, you know, you hope that they don't overthink it and overanalyze and overdate it, if you like. And you sort of just hope that the process, and I'm sure it will be, because, you know, Michael Edwards has shown, you know, in the transfer market, and that's how he's built his reputation, if you like, that he makes good decisions.
So you're saying we're getting the Lazar Markovic of management? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I was
just I'm excited about that.
I was just about to caveat, because I know you have your Michael Edwards before and after Klopp. Is that what was a massive help was that he had the manager there to sort of, you know, when those players came in, he was the person who developed them. You know, you can only do so much. But yeah, I think that the problem is that, as you say, when Klopp came in, there was a clear, and because Ancelotti was the other one linked, wasn't it? And you've got two clear, massive managerial names. You haven't got that this time. Other than Alonso, there was no obvious candidate. And even Alonso would have been somewhat of a gamble, because he's still new into the game. And while his Leverkusen team have done brilliantly and could get an invincible treble, it's still a gamble. But any managerial appointment is a gamble in a sense. But it's one of those that it could go anyway at this point, because, you know, you would like to think that things are progressing behind the scenes, and I'm sure they are, because, you know, we're getting close to the end of the season at this point, and Liverpool need to have somebody ready to go for the first day of pre-season, but more to the point, to be in the door as quickly as possible for, you know, transfer plans and all that type of stuff. So the number of names is somewhat concerning, in a sense that you would like, by this point, you would have thought Liverpool would have, you know, probably got to the point where they're ready to appoint someone, and that might be the case. It's just very much being kept under lock and key. Gary O'Neill's, I just think, is a bit of a bizarre one. He's done an amazing job at Wolves, but I think for the sporting director who thought we needed to go in a different direction of Bournemouth, to think that he was then the right man for Liverpool would be a bit mad. I think Iraola's got a better chance than O'Neill. But I think that just sort of sums it up, that it's just a bit of a close your eyes and dip and see who's going to be favourite today.
Yeah, that's a big concern. James, there's so many names being bandied around. Do you think the new regime at Anfield, you know, obviously with Edwards as the CEO and Hughes coming in, do you think that's putting people off slightly in the sense that they want to see the way things go first? Probably the best thing to do for any manager now would be sit out the first year of the post-Klopp age and see if it all falls apart and then come in and pick up the pieces.
I definitely do think that just the magnitude of having to follow in the footsteps of someone like Klopp is bound to influence people's decisions. I think that's only natural. You know, they are incredibly big boots to fill. And that's why I think, you know, from the people I've spoken to, personality is such a big part of what Edwards and Hughes are looking for, because it has to be someone who backs himself to be able to handle that, to actually, rather than see that as, you know, something to fear, that you actually have to embrace it and say, well no, I can, you know, I can follow on from this guy, and I can ensure that there isn't some big drop off, and someone who's massively excited about the array of talent he's inheriting, rather than someone who wants to come in with a broom and clear people out and rebuild his own team. Because I think there's a feeling that there's an awful lot of very, very gifted young talent in that squad that just needs an excellent coach to help further tap into their potential once Jurgen Klopp and his staff move on. And I think, and personality as well, I think, you know, as well as being able to embrace the magnitude of the job, it's also someone who's capable of having that relationship with the supporters, because that's another big thing that I know Liverpool are looking for in this appointment, that it has to be someone that can tap into that kind of emotional side of things that Klopp has been so good at, in terms of harnessing the power of the fan base and having that very special bond between the play and style and the fans, and feeding off each other in terms of energy. That's why it is intriguing trying to like think about where they do ultimately turn in terms of an appointment, because, you know, there's the style side of things, which is obviously crucially important. You know, that I think experience is another thing, because you're talking about managing one of the biggest clubs in the world, and then personality.
Yeah, it sounds to me there, James, like you're saying, they've got to work on a lot of intangibles. I'd love to see the metric for personality. I'm sure they've got one. You know, I mean, I'm sure they've got one. Well, it's going to be an interesting few weeks. I think it's going to be a very, very interesting few weeks. And it wouldn't surprise me if we get someone who's a little bit out of the blue, let's say.
If Liverpool make something of this surely final opportunity, McAllister takes it.
Defending by Everton, it might be a shooting chance for Steven Gerrard, and it's another phenomenal strike.
And it's come through to Michael Owen. Liverpool take the lead. Michael Owen does it again.
Cal held his nerve to bring Liverpool level. Now, can he win the derby for Liverpool? He can! Liverpool have won the derby thanks to two penalties against nine men Everton.
Still Daniel Sturridge.
Oh, it's come back off the post. Mane! Derby day delight for Liverpool.
Coleman caught on it by Salah, and Salah is off and running now. Catch him if you can. Mo Salah! Brilliant! There is no catching him.
We're talking of into the blue. It's the derby, isn't it? Well, I love the derby. The derby's brilliant. Over the years, there have been some magnificent games. And while it might not have the edge of, say, some of the games against Manchester United, the little local difficulty has always been fun. James, you moved to the city and you've been reporting on these games for how long? More than a decade. What games do you remember as really standing out for you?
Do you know what? My first ever Merseyside derby actually as a fan was the Fowler sniffing the line at Anfield.
Lovely.
What was that one great, must have been, was that about 98, 99, something like that?
Mm.
And then obviously, yeah, moved up to Liverpool permanently 2005. And it feels like in terms of the Goodison derbies, I don't know, it's probably difficult to look beyond that, the last minute winner. Was it Sadio Mane? That was a special one. And there was, yeah, just some unbelievable scenes that night. It feels like there's been a lot of draws at Goodison over the years. Some dark moments as well. I think back to the infamous one under Roy Hodgson, that 2-0 defeat that he described as the best performance of the season. Yeah.
And, but we just want to say we're contractually obliged to get mentioned of Roy Hodgson in every podcast.
that was a particularly grim afternoon. But yeah, there's been a fair few stalemates, but it's one of those places where I think probably winning away at United has the edge. I think maybe it's a generational thing, but for me, like growing up, you know, in kind of like the 90s and having to watch United win trophy after trophy, I think there is something very special about seeing Liverpool go to Old Trafford and win. But yeah, the derbies are still absolutely, you know, to be cherished. But, you know, obviously with the situation that Everton have been in for quite some time, they lack that same edge, don't they? Because the kind of the brutal reality is that Liverpool and Everton have been operating at different levels for a long time.
Do you feel the same way, Andy?
I always, because you get this question a fair bit, isn't it? What's bigger, Everton or United? I think Everton's the game that I look at as the one you definitely never want to lose. I can sort of get over losing to United, maybe not at the moment because they are rubbish, but generally, you know, over the years when they've been, you know, one of the forces in the Premier League.
Well, the thing is, you're not going to work with United fans in general. You're not like, you know, members of your family aren't United fans. You know, your mates aren't United fans.
Yeah, that's the thing I was going to come on to. Going into school after the derby was, you know, make or break, I think, as to how it was going to be, how your week was going to be, how your month was going to be. Because, you know, you were going to school with Everton fans, your mates are Everton fans. And yeah, I think that's why, for me, that's probably why it would mean a little bit more in that sense, because it's that element of you just never wanted to walk in after losing to Everton because it was just unbearable. And thankfully it didn't happen that much, but when it did happen, it was not very good. So I much prefer when Liverpool are winning those games, whereas, as you say, it's less of a thing when it's Man United until you go to university and you get it, people from everywhere who generally tend to support Man United. So that's when that becomes a bit more annoying. But yeah, I think that's why Everton's the game I never, ever, ever want to lose, because you never, ever want to lose a derby.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, there's a special feeling about it in a different way to Man United, you know. And the one thing I'll say, James, I mean, I could never see, and maybe I'm wrong, but I could never see City superseding either of those games.
Yeah, it's just completely different with City, isn't it? Because I think the Everton and United ones always carried that extra edge because of the history and your tradition that just doesn't exist. It's such a kind of a modern, almost manufactured rivalry, isn't it? The one with City, and it doesn't have that same feel, does it? It doesn't. I think as much as you know, obviously there's a degree of animosity that's grown between Liverpool and City with competing for titles over the last kind of decade, but it doesn't, I don't know, losing to City doesn't resonate and kind of wreck your day and your week as losing to United or, you know, or Everton does, because, you know, I think the City thing is just very different, isn't it? Because it's almost, because you're talking about a club that's got infinite resources, it's just easier to shake off.
You're listening to Walk On, brought to you by The Athletic.
As we feel about this trip to Goodison, it seems to me that their win over Forest at the weekend almost certainly guarantees them Premier League football next season. But they're still rubbish, let's be honest. They're still absolutely rubbish. Without the points deductions, they'd be mid-table rubbish. But, you know, is this a chance, Andy, for us to run up the score and claw back some of those goal difference issues that we've got with Arsenal in the title race?
Hopefully. I mean, that would be ideal, wouldn't it? I can't work out whether them winning at the weekend was a better result for Liverpool or not, because I just feel like they might just try and sit in and get a point now and not have the need to win the game. Because I think you're right. I think they're pretty much safe. It was a good result from Burnley's perspective. I'll throw that in there, because somehow they're still alive in the relegation fight. But yeah, I can't really work out, because if they needed to win the game, if they got beat by Forest, then they would have had to win. So they would have had to have come out, and that probably would have played into Liverpool's hands more. Whereas I think I can see Sean Dyche, and knowing how he sets up against big teams, I can see him playing for a few corners and just sitting in in his own half, compact, really if difficult to play against, and right, come and beat us type thing. And I don't know. I mean, you'd like to think that Liverpool should still have more than enough to do that, but it just makes it a more difficult game, doesn't it, than if it was a bit more open and you'd think Liverpool would be able to pick Everton off. So, yeah, but I'm not quite sure if them winning was a good thing or not. But equally, as you say, they're rubbish. So, forgetting everything else, Liverpool should just beat them, because Liverpool are much better than them. I've got much better players than them. And it's only the fact that it's at Goodison and it's a derby, and as James said, this always feels like it's a draw. And Liverpool have been there, and, you know, it's not really recent anymore, but, you know, a good few years ago now, and got a 0-0. I think it was 0-0 when they, you know, they needed to win. Was it 18-19 when they went to Old Trafford and went to Everton and drew both of those games? And ultimately, that's how they lost their advantage to City. But it's one of them as well. I think Liverpool are in the position now where it's just go for it. You know, just try and win every game. There's nothing to lose, in a sense. And other people have got to lose the title now. So just go for it and try and not, definitely do not play the occasion, which Liverpool teams can do.
And for me, the good thing about Everton staying up is that it guarantees we have the derby. You know, we might scoff at our blue brethren, but, you know, it's nice to have them in the Premier League, and it's nice to have derbies. And the City does need two Premier League teams, if you ask me. But let's have a bit of fun. Let's have a Merseyside derby quiz. Does one of you have to be Everton? Who wants to be Everton?
Can't one of us be Liverpool and Liverpool the other one Liverpool reserves?
Yeah. Yes. That's a good idea. Well, all right. Well, let's have a question for Andy. Ian Rush. Of course, we all know he's the top scorer in derby history. But how many goals did he score against Everton? Was it 21, 23, 25, or 317?
Well, I wish it was the last answer. That would have been helpful. I believe it's 25.
It's Ian Rush. Can he score his fourth? It looks as though he has. Yes.
Oh, and he's right. Yes. The boy's right. The boy's scored.
He's off to a flyer.
The same clinical manner as Ian Rush. Oh, James, the captain, I've talked about him before. Stephen, how many did he score in derbies? 9, 10, 117, 115. I've just misread that. Sorry, 11. That wasn't even an attempt at a joke. I'm like, whoa, I don't remember all those goals. So I'll run there again. 9, 10 or 11?
I'm going to go 11.
Oh, over to you, Andy.
Oh, is it 10?
Poor defending by Everton. It might be a shooting chance for Steven Gerrard. And it's another phenomenal strike.
It's 10. Oh. 2-0 up, early doors. Andy, for you, in 7 visits so far to Goodison Park, how many goals have Liverpool scored under Jürgen?
Oh, Jesus.
It's multiple choice here. 7, 8 or 9?
I have no idea.
I can see James phoning a friend.
I'm going to go 9.
Oh, James, over to you. 50-50. Well, 7
many,
or 8?
How far are we going back? What is it, under Klopp?
Yeah, Jürgen.
Sorry, what are the choices again?
Well, for you, 7 or 8? I mean, you can say 9. Brandy's just said that.
Yeah, it's 9. It's definitely 9.
Well, there was the 4-1 win over Rafa, wasn't there? Then you got Sadio Mane for the 5.
He's shown us his working out.
Well, no, I can't remember where the other ones came in, because there's been a fair few nil-nils, and I'll go 7.
Oh, it's come back up the first, Mane!
7-7, and you pulled one back. 7, yeah. Game on.
Because it was a 2-2 as well. That's why I went high, because I thought, well, there's 6 in 2 games, so they must have scored more than 1.
So they've only scored in 3 visits. So it must have been the 4-1, the 1-0 with Sadio, and then the 2-2.
Well, you know, I mean, unless a producer guy's got it very, very badly wrong.
Because, definitely 9.
Let's face it, I haven't done the research. You know, James, to equalise, who scored more goals in Merseyside derbies? Sadio Mane, Robbie Fowler, or Dirk Kuyt?
Oh, see, Dirk did love a Merseyside derby goal, didn't he?
He did.
Trying to think how many Robbie would have got. I'm going to go Dirk Kuyt.
Oh, I'm going to throw that over to you, Andy, to give yourself a cushion again.
Must be Fowler.
What a moment for Robbie Fowler.
Robbie got 6, and Mane and Kuyt both got 5.
Oh,
this is it. This is like these penalty shootouts. If you get this one, Andy, you know, basically you can run off the pitch celebrating. You know, you can turn and cup your ear to the lower division team you're playing. You know, all that sort of stuff. Our other contractual obligation here is fulfilled because Brendan Rodgers gets a mention.
Oh, God.
Final game as Liverpool manager came at Goodison Park, a 1-1 draw. Can you name both goal scorers that day?
Oh, Ings scored for Liverpool.
He did.
I'm trying to think who would have played for Everton at that point. No multiple choice on this one, though.
No, and it doesn't even get you half a point because that would give you the game. And frankly, I'm not prepared to do that.
I know I'm going to name a player who probably didn't even play in the game or something. Morales.
Oh, no, James.
Lukaku.
Sometimes after 2 or 3 years, people maybe get fed up looking at you and listening to you and they need something else.
And you've got it right.
Oh, get
it
right.
I thought that was the obvious, so I didn't go for Lukaku.
The mood turns. And so we come to the final question. Who scored the winning goal in Liverpool's first Premier League victory at Goodison Park? Premier League victory at Goodison Park. Because we all know that football was invented in 1992. And anyone who says it wasn't, I'm going to go round their house and I'm going to give them a Chinese beer.
Is this multiple choice or not?
No.
Oh, my God. Have you got any clue on what year this was?
Oh, yeah, I was there.
That's helpful.
I'm not telling you, am I? I mean, if I give you this year, you'll get it in a second. It's too easy if I give you the year.
I genuinely don't. Michael Owen.
Oh, no. I have to throw it over to you, Andy.
Can I have the year? Because I might not have been born.
No. No. Do you think I'm going to give you preferential treatment?
Yeah. If it was before 98.
Here's a clue. It wasn't.
Right. Oh, God. Now the pressure's on. Well, in that case, I'll go Gary Mack.
If Liverpool make something of this surely final opportunity, McAllister takes it. Oh, yes! What a goal!
And it's a winner.
Wow, that's a massive clue.
Yeah, and it's a little bit like, you know, VAR, you know, if I was you, James, I would immediately put up a tweet accusing me.
He's a Liverpool fan.
Yeah.
That is typical of this corrupt podcast.
I'll send you the tenner, Tony. No worries.
Well, James, what are we expecting from the team?
I think Klopp will shake it up again. It wouldn't surprise me at all if we see the likes of Salah and McAllister coming back into it. It'd be interesting to see what he does with Darwin Núñez, who I think there's a question there over whether that was less about just giving him a breather and more that he's been struggling for belief in front of goal to such a degree that you just take him out the firing line. So I think that would be an interesting one. Gravenberch is an interesting one as well, because you almost think, having had that big confidence lift of scoring at the weekend, and do you keep persevering with him? Same with Cody Gakpo. I thought, you know, more than justified his inclusion. So yeah, some big decisions there for Klopp in terms of getting that. It's about getting that balance, isn't it, between freshness and belief and people that are in that rhythm at the minute. It will certainly be a very, very different Everton to the one that capitulated at Stamford Bridge, because they will be bang up for this. But Liverpool should have too much for them. And then it'll be really interesting, because then, you know, from a position where it felt like the title had gone after that miserable defeat to Palace, you know, suddenly if you get the job done at Goodison, you're 4 points ahead of City. They've got two games in hand. And that just asks a few questions, doesn't it, of Guardiola's side, who, you know, haven't had everything their own way recently either, with going out the Champions League and then just about finding a way to beat Chelsea in the FA Cup semis. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Just vitally important that Liverpool build on that morale-boosting win at Fulham, because, as we've always said, you know, they can't waste time and energy thinking about other results. That's for us to do, and they just need to take care of their own business and hope that winning these last five is enough.
Yeah, and Andy, you know, you mentioned earlier on your familiarity with Daesh, you know, to, you and him are mates and hang together and all that sort of stuff. You know, dogs of war. You know, dogs of war, that was first used in, what, 1994, 1995. It's like one of those, you know, sort of video games that gets worse and worse the longer it goes on, isn't it? But, you know, the one thing is, Daesh is going to make it difficult, isn't he? He's going to make it physical. In his dream world, it'll be a grim test of endurance.
Yeah, definitely. I think Everton's mentality at the minute was the fact that Burnley turned up at Goodison Park and Daesh wanted to make the game ugly and horrible, and Burnley are rubbish. So it feels like that's their mentality just generally. But yeah, you're right. And he's had some success against Liverpool to an extent, you know, with his setup, and Liverpool have not always had it their own way against it. Well, didn't have it all their own way against Burnley teams. Largely won most of them, but, you know, it was difficult and they had to work for them. And Burnley obviously broke the Anfield run, didn't he, with the Ashley Barnes' penalty. So he'll have a setup in mind. It's probably going to be, don't give them anything, and very much, can we try and break and can we try and use Calvert-Lewin probably to try and hold up and let us get up the pitch. But yeah, you're right. It's going to be that mentality of get stuck in, everything goes, no messing about, it's nothing silly. And it's just about Liverpool trying to rise above it a bit, really. And I think what this Everton team have shown, though, is that they're not as disciplined as what Daesh's Burnley team have been in the past. There will be mistakes from them. You know, Chelsea just scored six past them, you know, last week. So it's not like this is an unbelievable, excellent defence that, you know, is impenetrable. So Liverpool have just got to make sure that they don't rush things, they don't panic too early, and they're just calm and controlled, which unfortunately hasn't been the case enough in front of goal recently. But I think Fulham was a positive in that it felt like they were returning to that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't wait to see how Dice sets up. What's uglier than ugly? Oh, it will be Everton in the derby. And then, of course, James, we got briefly mentioned, well, West Ham at the weekend, another away game. And David Moyes, renewing our acquaintance with David Moyes, who we're also familiar with from epics such as the derby.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it'll pose a different type of question, won't it? Because it is that dreaded 12:30 on a Saturday slot that Klopp dislikes so much. And I think we know that the Merseyside derby is unlikely to be plain sailing. It'll be probably mentally and physically draining. So it's a quick turnaround, especially with the trip down to London and the danger with those 12:30 Saturday games, which Liverpool have had, you know, experience already this season, is that it can be quite sluggish and lethargic early on.
And that stadium was sluggish and lethargic anyway.
Yes, yeah, it really is. Yeah, with, you know, you need binoculars to see the pitch from from most of the spots. But yeah, I mean they're in a strange old situation, West Ham, aren't they? Because they've obviously had, you know, another really good European run off the back of winning the trophy last season. Yet, you know, there's an awful lot of unrest there, and you know, fans wanting Moyes to leave in the summer, as it looks likely at the minute. You know, they got an absolute walloping off Crystal Palace at the weekend off the back of losing to Leverkusen in the Europa League. And yet, despite all of that, and despite kind of the gloom, if you want, around the place, they're still eighth. And it is another tricky one to tick off, I think, especially in a run of away games. I think, you know, as good as it was to see Liverpool kick off that run with victory at Craven Cottage, you know, this is just an absolutely massive few days, because Everton, as we said, they will be bang up for it on Wednesday night. And then not only have you got to get the job done there, you've then got to rest and recover really, really fast and make sure you don't give West Ham a sniff, because they are a big, strong, powerful team, West Ham. And if you're not absolutely on it, they're one of those ones that can bully you a bit physically. So just a case of it, trying to ensure this momentum, you know, that they've got a little bit of after that much improved performance and the fluency we saw against Fulham, that they just keep building on that.
Yeah, and winner takes Amarin. not quite. Anyway, that's it for Walk On, your Liverpool podcast brought to you by The Athletic. Thanks to James and Andy for joining me, and you too for listening in. Well, let's see off Everton and then see off a man who was Mr. Everton at one time, David Moyes. And that would make it a very, very good week and set up going into the last phase of the season with all still to play for. See you next week.
The Athletic.